that we've got the author of this wonderful book, Susan Juby, and who's also written a number of others. And Susan is a child of the province of BC, so she's lived in the snow country, grew up in Smithers, I believe, and has lived on the island now for a number of years, and has decided, you know, that she could come to Tassus on our very good road today. So, and
special for you, Susan.
It was special. They fixed the road just for her. Anyway, I will turn it over to Susan. She has got some books here that are for sale. We have some cookies and some coffee. And I'm going to assume, because I didn't ask Susan this, but that at the end of the reading that she's going to be doing, that we can ask all the questions we want.
Okay. Great. Sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Elsie, and thank you, Harmony, for coaching me in the town. Yeah. I got lost on this road. Amazing how many times I was able to get lost on this one little road. So I'm glad to be here in Tassus again. I came here 20 years ago, and I do see quite a few changes. It has changed quite a bit. I've brought my little car, because I didn't trust our truck because it's having trouble, and my brother has a brand new sort of sport ute, and I was going to ask him, and then Harmony said something about rock chips, and I was like, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to bring my car and deal with the pain. I am from Smithers, and this is Mindful of Murder is my most recent book, and that is my 13th book, I think. So my first three books were about a girl called Alice McLeod. It was called the Alice series. So there was Alice, I think, Miss Smithers, and Alice McLeod, Realist at Large, and those books were set in Smithers. And then I moved to Nanaimo, and everything is kind of set in or near Nanaimo now. And I write for teenagers, and I write comedies for adults. So another one that you might be familiar with, I think some of your book club might have read, The Woolfield Poultry Collective. So that one is set in Cedar. I don't know if you've spent any time in Nanaimo, but there's a little kind of agricultural outskirts there at Cedar, and I used to keep a horse out in Cedar, and it reminded me so much of Smithers, of the people in Smithers. And so it's about a young woman who she's from New York, and she has dreams of becoming a self-sustaining farmer. You know how that's very popular. Of course, she has no farming skills. And so that sort of reflects my own desire to become a self-sustaining farmer. We live on a cliff. It's just rocks and shade and drought. And so I tried growing things in like the one little patch of sun. Anyway, extremely unsuccessful farmer. So every time I write a book, it's because I want to, there's some element of the story that I wish was true for me. And so in this book, Mindful of Murder, the character is a former Buddhist nun. So very calm, very relaxed. I am not. And I really, every time I write a character, I'm like, I wish I was like that. So Helen is she's a very spiritually evolved person. Again, I am not. I have a meditation practice that is a work in progress. And her story is that she was a former Buddhist nun, and she left the monastery and went to work at a retreat center, which is loosely based on, I don't know if any of you have ever been to Hollyhock.
Yeah, Cortez.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Hollyhock, yay! Welcome. Hello.
I can move over here.
Hey, Mom and Dad. Sorry. No secrets in this.
Are there enough chairs?
Oh, no, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're grab some chairs. Thank you. Sorry.
Yeah, not at all.
Nice to see you. This is called Tassus.
I love it.
I'm gonna take your spot so they can sit together, if that's okay. Yep, we're here.
I didn't either. I only forget to say right now.
So I just wanted to, this is a good crowd. Way to go, Tassus.
You'll get your money later.
I don't know what I'll say when I get a flat tire partway through that gravel road. I'm there till Tuesday. So this book is the beginning of a crime series. It's about, I was saying, a former Buddhist nun who goes and takes over a retreat center. The island in this is based on Cortez. I didn't call it Cortez. I called it Sutil Island, just based on the sort of naming conventions of the Discovery Island. And I'll read you a little bit from the beginning. Her former boss is going to retire, and she wants Helen to get a job that is going to pay her well. And so I don't know how many of you keep up with butler culture. but there is such a thing as butler culture. And if any of you are looking for a new career, butlering pays really, really well. There are butler colleges in the Netherlands, they're in England, in Toronto. And so you can go to one of these schools, pay a lot of money, tuition, very, very expensive. But if you come out of there, you can make like $100,000, $200,000 a year. So, and there's, we have a new billionaire on this planet, something like every 2 hours. And a lot of these people, these nouveau riche people, think that what you need if you're going to be a billionaire is you need a butler. So before the Second World War, there were tons of butlers, and now there's tons of butlers again. So that's what Helen is. She's a former Buddhist nun butler. I'll read you a little bit from the beginning of this. I've always wanted to write a crime novel because I love to read crime novels. So this is the beginning of the novel. And this is Edna's former employer at the Sutil, or the Yatra Institute, which is quite loosely based on Hollyhock, which is somewhere I go on silent retreat every year. I will say that I go on silent retreat where you're supposed to just be silent, and you're supposed to just think and walk very, very slowly, and sit and meditate, which we do for hours every day. But sometimes I, you know, I'm a writer, I get a little thinky. I start walking a little faster. And so that's where the idea for this book came, on a walk that was supposed to be slow that turned out to be fast, that included all the inspiration for this. So this is a prologue. Edna Todd was in love with herself, and had been for a long time. Her lavish self-regard was built on a bedrock of appreciation for her good looks, still very much in evidence, her strong, flexible body, and what she considered to be a vivacious and intriguing personality. Having such a warm relationship with herself had made her 3 months self-guided retreat not just tolerable, but richly enjoyable. And now that the 3 months were nearly over, she felt an added satisfaction, bordering on elation, that she'd finally accomplished her goal. She'd completed Plan A, which meant she'd finally, at long last, decided what to do with the Yatra Institute, her retreat center, which she loved almost as much as she loved herself. In the stillness of her office, Edna adjusted her posture at her desk. Posture had always been a major concern. Once she felt aligned, she went about relaxing the various muscles of her face and diaphragm, which aided in breathing, another area of abiding concern. This done, she took 3 long intentional breaths, noting where one ended and the next began. It was a routine she performed at least 4 times a day and a critical part of her extensive self-care regimen. Then she went back to writing in her lovely new journal. She should have dealt with her estate long ago. If she could be said to have any personal failings, procrastination was certainly one of them. So was a certain level of disorganization when it came to tiresome paperwork. Edna, toned and lean at 72, considered herself to be in late middle age. She worked hard to stay fit, even when she was in isolation, and took pains to dress becomingly. This evening, she wore a crisp, line-dried white cotton pajamas. Her long silver hair, made more dramatic with iron-gray lowlights that she touched up every 6 months, fell around her angular face in a way she secretly thought suggested a certain inner depth. With the big decision made, every part of her felt lighter. So she gets ready for bed, and as she goes into bed, she takes a potion, her magnesium, and things don't go well. Okay, so, and she sees a figure standing at the end of her bed, and then she expires. She is dead. Okay, so that is the introduction. That's Edna Todd, and this is our introduction to our protagonist, Helen. The new butler stood in a line in front of a gleaming white yacht. They wore dark shoes and polished shoes. Their nails were clean and their hair was neat. All but one were drunk. "Excuse me," called the photographer who had been hired by the North American Butler Academy to take graduation day photos. "You there, third from the left, brown-haired gal, could you please move over one?" Helen Thorpe, the only sober butler, changed places with a lean and 30-ish man. She was 5 feet 10 inches tall, half an inch taller than the man she replaced. Better, better. Okay, that's better, said the photographer, who was a scurrying sort of person. He bent down and aimed the lens of his camera at the row of 9 butlers. Beautiful! Look at you! So tidy! Show me your best butler faces. The butlers kept their faces exactly the same as they would do throughout their careers. Pleasant, professional, impassive. Among them, Helen Thorpe somehow seemed extra still, as though her very molecules moved more slowly. She watched the little photographer with clear, thoughtful eyes. She saw that he was darting hither and fro on the dock, not paying the slightest attention to where he was going. She saw that his clothes, though clean, were not new. The heels of his shoes were worn down. He was making a strenuous effort to do a good job. The only expensive thing on him was his camera, which was not brand new, but of exceptional quality. He was, she thought, probably beginning his business as a photographer. Something about the way he strived to keep them amused and get the best shots suggested an attempt at a fresh start. Honest effort poured off him. He knelt on a bench bolted to the middle of the dock, and then he climbed up a pole with rungs on it, holding on with one hand and making dramatic attempts to shoot with the other. The butlers, who'd been up all night, watched him work with well-disguised bleariness. They'd kicked off the festivities the night before with a lavish dinner at a fine French restaurant, followed by visits to a series of bars and clubs. After they closed down the speakeasy at 3:30 a.m., they'd gone to the beach for a sunrise bonfire. At 5, they'd headed back to their dorm rooms in the old mansion that housed the North American Butler Academy, which, according to the marketing materials, was in the business of creating specialists in domestic excellence. They cleaned themselves up for the early morning photo shoot, which would involve group shots and individual portraits to be used for their professional profiles on butler.com. Helen didn't drink, and had quietly put herself in charge of keeping the rest of the butlers from being roofied or otherwise coming to harm. No butler left behind, she'd said to the youngest of them, a girl from Virginia by way of Ireland named Murray, whom Helen had retrieved from behind a leatherette couch in the quiet room of a dance club, filled with music that sounded like multiple emergency vehicles converging on a construction site. I love you, Helen, Murray had said. Everyone loves you. You're so relaxing. All night, the other graduates gave versions of the same speech to her. She smiled, enjoying the feeling of caring for them. They were butlers, so they were easy to love. Helen knew not everyone in her new career would be so easy. Her job would be filled with difficult people, the way most jobs were. One shot, with all of you smiling, said the photographer, who had slick back hair and a face that was faintly haggard under his tan. He gave them a strange little smile as though to demonstrate what a smile was. The hungover butlers gave indistinct smiles in return. Yes, yes, that's right. Everyone likes a butler who can smile, am I right? He muttered as he clicked away. Okay now, he said, standing and nearly running backward to get a new angle. Beautiful, beautiful, but... Before he could finish, his heel hit the lip of the dock and he pitched backward. His body went rigid and he began to windmill his arms. The camera flew into the air like a brick hurled in a riot. Helen reacted instantly. She took 4 giant steps and caught the device before it could smash onto the dock. Then she set it down and stepped over to look at the photographer, who was thrashing around in the oily water. Help! He screamed, coming up for air. Can you swim? She asked, though it was obvious he could. He'd already started churning his way toward a ladder hanging off the side of the dock, moving with all the ease of a pug in a pool, which is to say, without much ease at all. What? He spluttered. Are you okay? Said Helen slowly. Yes! He spit out a mouthful of water. My goddamn camera, my life is ruined. It's here, she said, holding it up. Don't worry, I've got it. It's safe. He reached the ladder and scrambled up, trying to catch his breath. You saved my camera? Instead of me? He stared at her. Before Helen could respond, he went on. You're a goddess, he said. I spent the rest of my money on that lens. For this gig, I could kiss you. He gazed up at her calm face, and something about it caused him to revise his words. But I won't, obviously. Helen's going to be the best butler since Jeeves, said Gavin Vigmucki, the elegant man who'd come to stand beside Helen. He reached out a hand to help the photographer back onto the dock. Someone will get you a towel from the ship, said Helen. The photographer, whose slick look was even more pronounced now that he was soaked, appeared almost undone by the near disaster. But something about Helen's kind, matter-of-fact manner restored him to himself. Yes, of course, said, my bad. I get a little worked up sometimes. Never shot butlers to before. To be honest, this is my first corporate gig. Helen nodded. You're doing very well. I fell in the fucking ocean, said the photographer. It's absolutely fine, said Gavin soothingly. Helen saved the day. Of course she did, said Murray Cleary, the young butler who wore her black hair in a neat French braid. She was breathless from her dash up onto the yacht. The Silicon Valley owner rented it to the academy so they could train butler candidates in yacht management in exchange for free butler service when he took it out. Murray gave the photographer a fresh monogram towel. He wiped off his face and hair. Losing that camera would have been the end of me, he said. This shoot is the difference between eating and not. Helen looked at him with such kindness that he wanted to cry, though he couldn't have said why. 5 minutes later, the photographer was once again clicking away, pausing every so often to wipe his wet hair out of his eyes. And when they finished the shoot, the photographer shook each of the butler's hands with his, now as damp from sweat as from ocean water. In my next life, I want to be a butler, he said, when he reached Gavin, who had the kind of good looks that made people stare. You people are all so calm. We merely appear that way, said Gavin. Helen, on the other hand, actually is calm. Murray leaned in toward the photographer. We think she used to be something special, like a magician or a battlefield nurse. Probably with the Canadian version of the CIA, said Gavin. Somewhere where you have to be cool-headed. The three of them turned to watch Helen, who had boarded the yacht. She reached for her phone, looked at the screen, and put it to her ear. Even from that distance, there was something compelling about the deliberate way Helen comported herself. Helen, said Gavin simply, and they all understood it was complete thought. Helen. So Helen is put in charge of administering the late Edna's estate. And what that involves is she's got some relatives that have to be included. So she's got a couple of nephews, and so there are four of them. And she is in charge of deciding who is going to run the Yatra Institute. And she has to do that using courses that that they run at the Yatra Institute. And these include kind of a Buddhist floral design. So it's a very peculiar kind of thing where you try to express your inner self through flower arranging. And you may not be aware of this, but flower arranging has things like that. I do all kinds of ridiculous research for all of my books. And one of the things I looked into was different kinds of floral design. And so they end up having to compete in floral arranging. I'm not sure if you've ever looked into competitive floral arranging, but it's hardcore. I have a passion for any kind of weird competition. So in this book, Wolfield Poultry Collective, there's competitive show chickens. Some of you have probably met competitive show chickens. There's quite a few of them in there, the dark underbelly of competitive poultry. Yeah. And here we have competitive floral arranging. So the candidates have to do this floral arranging with a very eccentric a floral educator. And then they also have to do interpretive dance from sort of martial arts inflected interpretive dance. And then they have to do meditation. And based on their performance in each of these courses, she decides who is the right person to inherit the institute. And so it was lots of fun to write. It's kind of a madcap thing, but it's also kind of a Buddhist thing. So I thought whenever you're writing a detective story, I teach creative writing at VIU. And one of the things I teach my students, are any of you hardcore crime fiction people? Anybody love the murder mysteries? So when I fall in love with a detective, it's for life. And yes. We're together forever. But to write it, you're kind of always trying to think, like, who would be an interesting person that we haven't seen yet? And I thought, okay, well, we haven't seen a Buddhist nun exactly. And we've seen butlers, but they usually did it. So what if we had a butler who didn't assault? And I have a lifelong obsession with P.G. Woodhouse. Anybody here read P.G. Woodhouse? The Bertie and Jeeves books? If you like comic stories, those are some of the funniest books ever written. And they remain incredibly funny. P.G. Woodhouse was in his time. He's got this client. There's Jeeves, who's the butler, and then there's Bertie, who's his client, who's just kind of a numbskull. And so the two of them are always, you know, going off, and somebody's stealing a policeman's hat, and you know, Jeeves spends a lot of time trying to fix Bertie's hangovers. Anyway, it's extremely delightful, silly stuff. So I wrote this book and had a great time with it. It took me 7 years to write it for some reason. It took quite a long time, and then the publisher asked for two more. So I've just finished the second one, which is set in Vancouver, in West Van, Vancouver, and then it's set at a ranch sort of in the Williams Lake kind of area, like up in that country there. And then I just started the third one in the series.
With the same characters?
Yes. So each time Helen goes, she has these employers, the Levines, who are extremely gracious and wealthy and lovely to work for, but they keep loaning her out. So in the new book, she's just given them a beautiful retreat, and they feel so moved by how wonderful it was that they loan her out to one of their friend's children, who is very, very wayward young woman who lives in a hotel and is on the internet for a living. And anyway, so Helen gets dragged around the influencer circuit in Vancouver, and it just is complete chaos. Going to electronic...
Are they all murder mysteries?
They're all murder mysteries, yeah. There's multiple murders in the next one. And I imagine there'll be quite a lot of... the third one is going, I think, I haven't quite decided. Have any of you been to Yellow Point Lodge? Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, so Yellow Point in Nanaimo is one of my favorite places to go and have somebody cook for me. It's fantastic. And I thought, well, maybe I could just base it loosely on Yellow Point. So it, pretty soon, no hotel or lodge in anywhere is ever going to let me visit. Because I will just change the name and use one of my books. Anyway, I haven't quite decided that yet. So that's that. I am happy to, I can read a little more. There's a section from the Wolfield Poultry Collective that I always love to read. It might take me a minute to find it, but in this one, as I say, I had an obsession with farming, and I also really, really like writing about the kinds of people I grew up with. So I grew up in Smithers, and there was just a certain kind of guy who really, really, really enjoyed heavy metal and having cocktails. The bush parties. There's a certain kind of guy that I really enjoy writing about. And so there's a character in here called Seth, this is written in four voices. So there's Prudence, who's the woman who comes from New York and wants to be a farmer. And then there's Seth, who becomes, rents a room after his mother kicks him out so she can move her boyfriend in. And then there's Sarah, who's a young girl who has competitive show chickens that have to get moved out of the suburbs. And then there's Earl, who's in his 70s, and I also love bluegrass, and his story is based kind of on, what's the name of the father of bluegrass? Anybody remember?
Oh, Earl Scruggs.
Lester Flatt, Earl Scruggs.
It's going to come to me as soon as I walk out of here. Anyway, there was the main guy, originally for bluegrass, and he had brothers who were also very good, and then he had one brother who was a screw-up, who was in charge of, they had, a fairgrounds where people would go, and he was really not very good at doing the maintenance and stuff, so they'd have stages falling down, whatever. Anyway, Earl is based on that character. And it was lots of fun coming up with their little voices. So, here we go. This is the part. So for this book, I did research into competitive show poultry. I was in 4-H as a kid. Do you have 4-H here? Do you have any agricultural animals? That's what Tess is.
We have chickens.
This here would be a great place for some show chickens. and I went and I spoke to small-scale farmers around, and they all told me just these horror stories looking after their livestock. And so in this book, they have a single sheep that's left on this farm after the owner dies. And the sheep's name is Birdie. And they decided to do a new thing with Birdie where they shaved half of her so that it was not too stressful. So the idea was to do it in stages. So they had half of her shaved and half of her not shaved. And then the person died. And so she was left half shorn. And so they all get together, and they are like, well, we have to finish shearing this sheep. And so what we need to do is watch a video. if you are so inclined, I don't know, you're part of the library system here? Yes?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So you, too, can order the sheep shearing video that I watched. This is based on. Okay. So I just ordered a video, and I was like, okay, this is going to show you how to shear a sheep. And so this, I'm going to read you a little section where Seth, who is a... trying to recover from a serious drinking problem, is watching a video in which they're planning to learn how to shear a sheep, shear the rest of poor Birdie. So this is Seth. Remember Linda Hamilton in the first Terminator movie? How buff she was? Yeah, well, the girl in the sheep shearing video was like that. There wasn't an ounce of fat on her except, where you'd want it.
I'm not a fitness guy myself, but I can appreciate a toned physique. Also, the way she handled that sheep and the clipper, which is this lethal-looking thing with these big spikes coming out of it, took my breath away. Her fashion sense is pretty much farmer in the Dell, but I don't mind that on a woman. She sure talked dirty, too, saying how you had to let the sheep empty out. First, I was so distracted by her pecs, I didn't even pick up on what that might mean. I thought it was either draining the poor sheep of blood when you cut its neck with those clippers, or I don't know. When she got shaving, I was basically glued to my seat. The animal was almost as big as she was, and she kept saying how you had to avoid its tits. I kid you not. Watching that video was like watching a slasher flick, only real with a sheep. There was a huge blood splatter on the floor just to the left of the screen, probably left over for a previous shearing. Whoever was working the camera seemed to have a bit of palsy or whatever because the camera swung around all over the place so you could see the blood sometimes. What must it be like to be a sheep and see what was practically a lake of blood off to the side when you're getting your annual haircut? This is enough to make me vegetarian, at least when it comes to sheep. When the girl finished the first sheep, she moved right on to manhandling another huge brute, a ram, she called it. She went on about how you shouldn't cut off its pizzle, and you have to be careful around its scrotum. And I was thinking, sweet Jesus, not only is this like a horror movie, it's getting like a porno. And the whole time she was talking, she was throwing that massive sheep around like it was a sack of feathers. And when he started kicking, probably because she was getting too close to his pizzle, she put a headlock on him, and that was the end of him acting up. You know those shows on Spike with the guys who jump motorbikes over flaming school buses and that little warning at the end, don't try this at home? That about sums up sheep shearing for me, seriously. I could barely watch, but I couldn't take my eyes away either. You can look at my archives if you want the full account. I live blog the whole thing, the way some people do for the Academy Awards. I put it on this new blog I started called Farmer John. So far there haven't been any comments because it hasn't. I can't believe little Sarah thought we should shave Birdie ourselves. I only stopped drinking like a week before, and I could barely shave myself, for fuck's sakes. The only consolation was that since Birdie's female, we weren't going to be faced with a giant scrotum that we'd have to try and not cut off by accident. Personally, I'll be tempted to let that part stay hairy. I watched the video all the way until the credits so I could get the name of that sheep girl. I might try to look her up online. Anyway, so I had lots of fun researching. Yeah. And there's a lot of details about them trying to deal with Birdie's hooves, and they're putting maxi pads on them, like in her injuries, they got maxi pads all over this poor sheep. And that I got from a farmer in Cedar who told me that's how they've dealt with the injuries to the sheep that they have accidentally done while they're trying to tackle their sheep. I never know what to say after I read that passage. But I'm happy to answer any questions about writing, or I don't know if there are any writers in this group, or one of my big interests is writing, and I always have, about small town life. And I love, in a small town, the mix of people that have to be together. I think that is the greatest thing. And when I grew up, found it very strange I grew up in Smithers, and I was deeply convinced that I was like a very cosmopolitan person. All evidence to the contrary. I mean, Prince George was the biggest place I had ever been. And I used to tell my mother when I was little that, people would say, where would you like to go when you get older? I'm like, Prince George or Africa? Like, to me, they were like, which one shall I go to? But there was something about, like, the way that people live side by each who are so different and have to interact in a small town that I think is very, very healthy. And then I went to Toronto, and I was like, oh, my God, these people don't have to have anything to do with people who are not like them. And there's something wrong with that. And actually, Toronto wasn't too bad that way. Vancouver was terrible that way. Just neighborhoods where everybody was sort of the same. And so there's something really precious about that that ends up. Also, small towns are so good at turning out weirdos. Yeah. as a dyed-in-the-wool weirdo, I have such tremendous affection. So almost all of my books are set in that kind of environment. And I'd love to, I just think of the people that I grew up with that I didn't necessarily appreciate at the time because I was too busy feeling cosmopolitan. but I did move to Toronto. That was my first big move. I when I was 19, 19. I moved to Toronto to go to fashion design school, mm-hmm. and because it was, they had a school there that had no standards, so they let me in. Nobody else was going to let me in. I really was not a successful high school student. And I remember getting, I moved there, like somebody from the college that I went to picked me up and dropped me off in downtown Toronto. And then I was like, oh my God, I've never taken a bus. I've never taken a taxi cab. I've never taken a streetcar. Never seen a subway. Nothing. And I got dropped off and I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? I don't know if anyone is, you know, has been in a city and very unfamiliar. And so I went out. I would go out of the house and then walk one block and get back to the house, and it was like I just survived Everest. I'm like, oh, look at this, I didn't walk. And on that first day on one of those rounds that I did, there was a fella who followed me, and I was supposed to be, I was the first one there, and there was supposed to be 16 other people coming to this house. It was a torn, you know, an old brownstone with 16 bedrooms, and I thought he must be another student. And so I let him in, and he was not a student. He was a... he was a what?
Creeper.
He was a creeper. he was a creeper, like very obviously a creeper. Once I'd been in Toronto for 3 days, but I was like, oh, look, another student. And then he tried to look up my skirt, and I ran into my room, locked the door, and didn't come out until a lot of students arrived, which was some time later. Anyway, so that's how sophisticated I was. And that, you know, there's kind of that sensibility that works its way all through my books. Yeah.
I'm interested in your very, very first. Mm-hmm. You finished your manuscript,
yeah.
And you were trying to get it looked at, published.
Yeah.
How did that go?
Awful. Thanks.
Yeah. No, I'm there.
It did.
Right now.
Yeah.
I'm there right now.
Oh, are you? Okay. So it's horrible. Some people like it's like shooting stars. The odd person, it goes very smoothly. So I had, just to back up a little bit, I dropped out of fashion design school, not good at fashion, really quite bad. Goodbye, Susan. Thank you for coming. We have no standards except for you. And then I went and I kind of pulled myself together a bit, and then I went off and I went to university. I got a degree in English. But I had been such a ne'er-do-well that I didn't have any confidence. And you need some certain kind of confidence to say, I'm going to write something and I think it's worth paying attention to. Like, it's quite nerve-wracking. And I was working in a publishing company, and people asked me, oh, was that super helpful to you in getting published? And I was like, no. All it did, we did nonfiction, so we did books about twig furniture and irritable bowel syndrome and stuff like that. So it was not like the high end of fiction publishing. And I knew, but I didn't know enough from doing that, that there's something called the slush pile. So first of all, I was shy about having written a book. So I wrote this book by hand on a bus on the way to work and then in an all-night coffee shop. So I had all these blank journals and I took them to my godfather. I went into the Okanagan to Salmon Arm, and I gave them to my godfather, and I was very shamefaced about it. I was like, it just felt like I'd done something sort of illicit or strange, like I'd given birth at prom or something. This is what I did! And I was waiting for him to say, you know, like, because I knew I gave him to my godfather because he would be nice, but he would also be honest, and he had the right sense of humor. So you don't want to give new work to people who don't, like, who do not share your sensibility. And so we read a little bit, and he came back, and he said, oh, Susan, sometimes when you really love a writer, you write like that writer, and that's great. Like, it was, I'm like, I'm derivative, woo! And so it was because a book called The Secret Diaries of Adrienne Mole, age 13 and 3/4, anybody ever read that? The Sue Townsend book? My first book, especially the beginning of it, had some echoes of that. That's one of the great comic novels of all time. It's really funny. And mine had some of the same stylings. But then I was in bed, and I heard laughter, like 1 o'clock in the morning, laughter coming out of the bedroom he shared with my aunt, and I nearly levitated. I'm like, oh my God, I made somebody laugh, yes! I was like, it was one of the great moments. And then he started saying, you should try to get it published. And so nobody likes rejection, and publishing is full of rejection. And so I would send it out. So what I did is I researched... first agents, and agents were like, thank you, but no, we're really, really uninterested. And so then I researched publishers, and so I just treated it like what I tell my students, my creative writing students, is treat it like a badly paid, unpleasant part-time job process of trying to get published. So you just like break it into manageable chunks, start sending it out, you know, get a decent query letter, and like, that's, you know, and then get ready. You know, my husband would come home and there would be, every time I got rejected, which was a lot, I'd be sort of in the fetal position on the couch. He's like, oh, God, you got rejected again. Can't wait for tonight. and I got rejected by, I think, almost every publisher in Canada and the States. I just got rejected. And then, but my godfather kept, he would call almost every day and say, did you send that up? Did you send it up? Don't give up. And so I just kept going. And one day I sent, so one of the publishers, I mean, I had lots of bumps in the road. One said they were going to look at it. They kept it for 4 months longer. And then they wrote back and said, thank you very much for sending this. It's not a good fit for us. And we no longer accept unsolicited manuscripts, which was code for don't ever contact us again. And I was just like, oh, this sucks. This is so bad. This is so unpleasant. But I sent it out, and another publisher said, we think this might be a young adult novel. And I was like, oh, I hadn't, even though I'd written about teenagers, I didn't think it was a young adult novel. So I started sending it to those people, got rejected because it was too, you know, edgy for them, and for children's publishers, it was too edgy for that group, and it was, anyway. But one guy read it in Saskatoon at a press called Thistledown, and he said, I think this is really funny. I'm going to talk to my board, and then they published it. So, but it was, it took quite a long time. And one of the best pieces of advice I got from somebody was, my job, like, yes, the getting published is a badly paid part-time job. Writing is your primary job. Keep all, like, just keep that part of you separate from the publishing part. If you don't have an agent, even if you do, like, your job is to write books that you find interesting, and the rest of it, you do your part, and like, it is, it's just sort of a, it honestly feels like a crapshoot sometimes. Some people I know, students and friends, have written some of the best books I have ever read that haven't gotten published. So, and then, you know, sometimes I read books and I'm like, okay, well, whatever. You know, you just don't know. It's a kind of a funny career, so.
Would you ever go to self-publishing?
Yeah, I think I would. I think I would totally go to self-publishing now if you have energy for doing the self-publishing stuff. So it's easier. The technology is easier than it ever has been, like printing them, like print-on-demand, all that stuff's made it quite easy. But you need to be up for the marketing part. And I think people who are comfortable online do better with self-publishing. A lot of you have talked about Cougar Annie's Garden, and Cougar Annie was a self-published book that did very, very well. But what they did with that book, so nonfiction's a little different with self-publishing because you have a niche audience. So Cougar Annie's Garden worked because it was beautifully done. They hired one of the companies I worked for to produce it, lovely photographs. And then they marketed that thing full time. Like, that's what you miss as a self-publisher is the publisher's marketing. That said, a lot of publishers do, like, the marketing is like, a marketing person walk past your book and it's like, yeah, I hope you do okay. And that's it. So you're kind of in charge of that. So I think self-publishing, great, as long as you have some energy for that part of it. Yeah.
What about the different voices? Like, with why writing was accidentally, each character point is thinking, talking, point of views are happening like
yeah.
this. Yours, I was listening, is it omnipresent?
So this, usually I write a lot in first person, so
okay.
The Wolfield Poultry Collective is 4 first person voices.
Okay.
This one is third person, it's called Third Person Limited. And so Third Person Limited is he or she or they, limited to one character, so we get access to one character's thoughts and feelings per scene. And then when you switch scenes, you can switch the character. And there's some first person in here too, because I have my devotion to first person. One of my first book addictions was Catcher in the Rye. And so that made me want to, I don't know if any of you caught that particular virus, but anyway, I read Catcher in the Rye probably 300 times. Yeah, I was sort of almost, yeah. I was deeply damaged by Catcher in the Rye. Yeah.
You reminded me of, when you said that, of the towns of Sunshine Sketches of a Little Town.
Oh, yeah, the Stephen Lee Cobb.
Popped into my head
yeah.
when you said that.
Yeah.
And that was fun.
Yeah, yeah. Sunshine Sketches was, it's one of the big, you know, one of the big ones. And the Leacock Award now is, I don't know if any of you know the Leacock Award. So that's a, you know, that's our Canadian humor, which comes from Stephen Leacock.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions?
I have one of these guys. I'm a little bit embarrassed, but when I knew you were coming, I took out one of your young adult books from the library. And
okay.
I can't remember the name of it.
Okay.
But it was written in half was the book and half footnotes.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, oh, my God, that must have been painful to write.
it was
a little bit to read. I liked it, but it was tough.
It was a stylistic decision that, and people, there are footnote lovers.
Yeah.
And there are footnote haters. And people who hate them
in the middle.
Write to you.
Yeah.
Say,
yeah.
I hate your footnotes. And I hate you too. So the footnotes, part of the reason for that, so the Truth Commission is a book set in Nanaimo at a fictional art high school. And it's meant to be a creative nonfiction writing assignment. So creative nonfiction is the branch of true writing that is written like fiction. So there are a bunch of actually the footnoted nonfiction stories go back to, you know, they go way, way back. And it's a way of telling, like, there's multiple, you know, you have your story that's happening in the book, and then there's often, like a story happening in the footnotes, too. So some of my favorite writers do a lot of footnoting, but I know it's a hateful thing to do for some people. Mm-hmm. I did it, and I'm sorry.
I found it hard to read, but I also couldn't not read the footnotes.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, they're very insistent.
It got very associated with
postmodern writing, which doesn't want to make itself easy for you. It wants to like be very intrusive about the, this is writing, pay attention to this and this and this and this. Like Douglas Copeland had a lot of that. So it is us. And I love teaching creative nonfiction, and I like the intrusiveness of the footnotes. But as I say, I had discussions with editors where they're like, oh, this is a really great book. God, I hate those footnotes. I don't care. Having footnotes.
So when you wrote it, did you write the story first, then add the footnotes in, or do you flip back and forth? Or how?
I flip back and forth. So yeah. I would write it, and I would say, this is a place where she would stop, because it's her story, right? So
right.
She's writing what happened. And then she would stop and explain things. Or she would tell a little bit of background, or she would do...
Or she'd suck up to the teachers.
Or she'd suck up to the teacher,
yeah.
Because the footnotes are also a place for her to talk to her teacher. So it was very conceptual that way.
Yeah.
If you want an interesting example of a book with a lot of footnotes, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. Has anybody read that? By Juno Diaz. It's about life in the Dominican Republic. And it's also about a guy from the Dominican who's growing up in New York. And the author does a lot of footnoting about the Dominican. So there's the book taking place in New York, and then there's another story taking place in the Dominican about politics and stuff, and then there are these footnotes. And he does it really, he does it really beautifully. You might even quote a little bit.
Forget it, then. Just saying.
If you want more exposure therapy, you could try that book. Yeah. David Foster Wallace also does very good footnoting. Yeah.
So,
oops, sorry.
Mindful of Murder.
Yes.
Which I've read and I really enjoy. I really like the fact, because there's some books, when I read them, I get like four sentences into the chapter before I figure out what first person is saying that.
Yeah.
Yours, I could tell right from the very beginning, because you make it very clear which one of those characters that they are. Because
yes.
They're all so diverse.
Yeah.
In each of, you know, their thought processes or whatever it is, their movements even, that it made the book very clear, and I didn't have to go back and reread the beginning
right.
of the paragraph to figure out, oh, that's who it was. It was, you
yeah.
know, where that was. And so I just want to say for everyone that Mindful of Murder, because I haven't read any of the others yet, it's a very interesting book, but you will know who it is that's talking each time they're talking.
Well, that's a great compliment, because I spend a lot of time trying to get Like, if you're going to do multiple voices, if it's third or first or whatever, you know, like, I talk to my students about this all the time. They can't all sound the same because we're not the same. Like, the way we think is different, our vocabulary is different, our psychology is different, our sentence lengths are, like, all of it. And so then you know, you come up with a character, and then I spend infinite amounts of time, like editing so that it's exactly right for that person. Like, thinking, oh, okay, how did they grow up? Where did they go to school? What are their pop culture? What's their, like, what are all their cultural references? All that stuff. And it's, like, for me, that's the most fun part of writing a book, is coming up with the voices. Yeah.
I found that the same with the Poetry Collective, too. Like, you really knew who the characters were. You felt like you knew who they were, and they were all so different. It was, it was really interesting watching them work together.
Yeah. And I spent, again, lots of time, like, figuring that out, because they used to have really long chapters for each character, and then I decided short ones. And then they're all, like, so the way that book is built is that there's a whole bunch of things that happen, and we hear from all of them about each major event. Yeah, and so you get multiple perspectives, so it, for the purposes of comedy, it makes it more fun.
That's kind of neat. It's sort of like being in a small town, right? Because you'll hear a story from Harvey, and then you'll hear it from Brandon.
Exactly. and everybody's going to have a take, and it's going to be funny or terrible or whatever it's going to be, and that's part of, like, the fun of it. And also, in the Wolffield Poultry Collective, I made sure that they were really different. Like, you know, their ages are different, where they come from is different. It makes it a little easier than if they're all in the same age category and they all do the same stuff. That can
Do you do your own editing, or how important is an editor to successful?
Pretty important. So what I do is I write the books, however long that takes, and then I will generally do a bit of editing as I go, but I'll get the whole thing done, and then I'll edit it, like, quite a lot. Like, almost every word gets changed 2 or 3 times before I show it to anybody, and then I have a group of friends who are also writers, mostly, and my dad, who is he has a PhD in English, he reads them, so I've got a little group of people, and they each give me their feedback, and then I rewrite it again, and then I give it to my agent, and then she gives feedback, and then I give it to my editor. Because right now, unless you're, like, a huge, big name, they don't have any time. Like, publishers and editors have very little time. They don't, used to be in the old days, I think they would, like, really, you know, edit everybody. You know, now there's, if your book isn't, especially if you're not established, if your book isn't, like, absolutely airtight, when you send it in, they just won't publish it. And you can hire people to do that. I trained as an editor after university, after I finished flailing through fashion design school. And that did help me to get, you know, to, like, not be too precious about my writing.
So from the time that you finished the book, the second book, and to the point of where it's going to be published, which you think will be this winter, how much time was that? Because you're having to go through that process you just laid out.
Yes. So I do all that before my editor sees it. I handed the book
when
in.
When you finished the book, how long ago did you finish that second
book? So book two, I finished in March. I handed it in early March. Mm-hmm. I handed in the copy edits were done. I handed those back on Monday. Then I'll get another round of line edits and, you know, proofreading and stuff, and I'll read that and send that back. But it's usually, like, it goes in about a year before it comes out, if you're working with a bigger publisher.
Yeah.
So it's quite a long lead time, because they have to, like, pitch it to the stores and do all that, like, kind of try to hype it up before it comes out.
So you said it took you a really long time to write the first one of this. Yeah. Well, not a really long time, but
7 years.
7 years.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to write the second one?
8 months. So I was at last... because I was trying to get it right. I wrote other books while I was working on this one. So I wrote Me3, and I wrote something else while I was working on this book. It wasn't quite...
I'm not saying that you're lazy.
It just wasn't clicking. And so it didn't click until I was at Hollyhock and decided she should become a former monastic. And then I was like, oh, now I get it. Okay. And then the whole thing just fell into place.
So then did that make writing the second one?
The reason it took so long is because I needed everything set up for, I knew I wanted to write a series,
of course,
so I knew
yeah.
that I wanted a person, a detective, that I could just plop into different kinds of environments
yeah.
and have, I know how she's going to respond. Like, I know what her strengths are, I know what her background is, and I know what kind of people she's going to end up around. And so that, like, getting that
building
right.
Building that.
Yeah, I had to build up all, and so it was actually, I mean, it was quite painful because I teach full time. So I was trying to do the second book, and I was like, oh my God, marking, and like, yeah, it was very intense. Yeah. But yeah, and so the next one, it's due in February. Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah, no, it's great. I thought, you know, I wanted to have a mystery series. Who knows? And maybe it'll only be three books. Maybe I'll, you know. But I thought that was my big dream. As I thought, oh, I'd love to write a mystery series. Just like crank out a book every year.
So how long is that list of I'd like to write about? Because you've gone, you wrote your first book was mm-hmm. about a teenager.
Three of those. Yeah.
Then you moved into. The
adult stuff and a middle grade, yeah.
And now it's adult stuff still, but
yeah.
the mysteries.
Yeah.
So you must have a list mentally, if not anywhere else,
yeah.
that says, you know, someday I might want to.
Yeah, it's infinite. And I keep saying, no more. Stop coming up with new ideas. Just do it. So I would like to keep writing about Helen as long as people want to read about Helen. And I came up, I was on retreat, I just came off retreat about 3 weeks ago, and I came up with another idea. I mean, I'm supposed to be retreating. So I don't tell my teachers
that. There's no brain rest going on.
Well, I try, a lot of the time, I'm deeply meditative, but then I'm, dang, oh! So, yeah, I don't bring a computer, I have to just remember it all. So, yeah, I have another idea for, and I didn't want to write YA anymore, but I had an idea that I think is pretty good. And then I had an idea for another comic novel. All over the place, yeah. But there's only so much time, right, when you teach mm-hmm. full time, so.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
there's
yeah.
a second book with the poetry collector.
Yeah,
and
The Republic of Dirt.
Okay.
I'm sorry? The Republic of Dirt.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want that one, too.
Yeah, it's, yeah. I had lots of fun with that one. Yeah.
So. Same characters,
yeah. They're just further down the road of ruin. Ruin and triumph.
We know all about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's it. I thank you all for your generous questions and for coming out. Tassus has a very lively literary scene here. It's awesome.
And I would like people to have some cookies, please, and coffee, and please have a look at the books and continue asking.
Yeah,
Susan, questions. It's
yeah.
not like I'm kicking you out. It's just I want the cookies ate and
yeah.
the coffee drink.
Yeah.
Refreshment
time.
And I'd like to thank Susan for
thank you, Susan.
Writing yeah. such great books and for coming to Tassus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Come
great.
Woo. Fun. I'm so glad that we have a live literary society in our town
yeah,
here, you know?
Awesome,
like,
right?
Yay, audience! Wow.
And we're just visiting, and what a great night that we're
going
to come here.
Yeah, exactly.
Sarah, this is my
so nice
dad,
to meet
Don.
You.
Sarah.
I'm Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. I'm Don.
So nice to meet you, too. So glad. Your first time here?
No, we've been here twice before.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I'm going to